All please rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you very much. Y'all may be seated. Thank you. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. It's a pleasure to see you all here today. Justices Kelly and Theofanis and I are glad to have you and look forward to this oral argument. As you know, we have before us today a case of quite significance, 03-23248-CV, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice et al. Versus Canales et al. I'd love to have the counsels introduce themselves for the record, please.
Michael Abrams for the defense, Your Honor, and I'm joined at the counsel table by Ellen.
Thank you, sir.
Joseph Perkovich for appellees with Joseph C. Welling and Gretchen Scardino.
All right. Thank you very much. As those that are here and that those that might be watching on YouTube today know, we'll have oral arguments this morning in this case. Each side has 20 minutes, and certainly I suspect the appellants will take 15 to open, then 20 for the appellees, and then 5 additional minutes for any type of rebuttal or closing comments this morning. As you know, we have the timekeeper today working the lights. When you see the yellow light, you have 2 minutes left, so you'll need to start wrapping up your thoughts. The red light means you need to stop. However, obviously, if you're in the middle of a statement, please feel free to conclude that, and I'm sure the myself and my colleagues may have a few questions throughout this proceeding today. We are having a few mic issues today. Hopefully, they will not impact this oral argument or the one after this today, but you may have some work by staff to make the mics work appropriately. As you also know, we are broadcasting live on YouTube, and we'll see how many followers you guys bring to bear with this very interesting case today. And are counsels ready to proceed?
Yes,
thank you. And counsel, you ready as well?
Yes,
all right. Let's hear from the appellants.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The trial court's decision should be reversed based on the broad grant of legal authority reflected in Article 4314, which leaves it to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to determine and supervise execution procedures by intravenous injection.
On that note, Your counsel, beyond 4314's limitation to intravenous drug, is there any limit on the discretion of the director?
Yes, and I would say there are at least four, and I can go through each of those limitations. So the first limitation that I would point to is in the Texas Constitution, specifically the prohibition in Article 1, Section 13 on cruel or unusual punishment. That's one prohibition. And of course, anything that the department does has to be in accord with the Texas Constitution, but that's a specific provision. I'd also, of course, point to the federal Constitution and the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And of course, those issues have been litigated in the Fifth Circuit in several cases, like the Whitaker case that we cite in our brief. So that's a second. The third is federal statutory law. So the department cannot violate applicable federal regulatory laws, and there are no allegations that we are. And then the fourth is, and I think this might be the most important for purposes of this case, is the political process itself. And what I mean by that is that since 2012, Texas has used a one-dose protocol of pentobarbital for injections, and since 2013, it has used compounded pentobarbital. And none of that is secret. I mean, everyone, you know, these issues have been litigated. The allegations that the Bayou State is a problem have been litigated. And so the legislature is aware of that, and the legislature has delegated the authority to TDCJ to establish these protocols. And the legislature could, in its discretion, say, you know, we have a problem with something that TDCJ is doing. But the legislature hasn't done that. In fact, it hasn't done that since 1977, when it amended the Article 4314 to change the process from execution by electrocution to lethal injection. And so I think that's why I filed the letter on Monday about the Granville case, which was from the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1978. And although that the case is from a bit ago, I think that it bears directly on the issues here, because there was a separation of powers attack on the statute. Basically, the attack was this left too much discretion to the director, to the Department of Criminal Justice. And the court rejected that argument and said, look, it seems to us that the legislature has set a broad policy that, and that is unquestionably a policy choice. How lethal injection or how executions will be handled is a policy choice, and the legislature has made that decision through lethal injection. Actually, I'm sorry, let me give another limitation on authority, which is the statute itself. So we're not saying that there could never be an ultra-vires claim. And let me give two examples of a potential ultra-vires attack on Article 4314. The first is that the statute says that executions have to be conducted after 6 p.m. On the day that they're scheduled. So again, if TDCJ is saying we're going to have an execution at noon, I think that's a valid basis to say you're acting outside your legal authority. The second is if TDCJ chose a different method of execution altogether than lethal injection. Again, that would be another point where I think someone could bring an ultra vires claim and say that's beyond what the legislature allowed for. But if I could turn,
just one question on that, since you're on that topic. Doesn't 4314's directive to use a lethal quantity sufficient to cause death imply some sort of standard of quality?
I think it is a directive that the execution has to be conducted such that, you know, at the end of the procedure, the condemned is deceased. And I think that, again, as Granville noted, the courts won't, in Granville certainly, the court didn't assume that the director would exercise that broad and very sensitive and important authority arbitrarily. And so, again, I think that's why Granville was so important, because the court noted, look, this is a broad grant of authority, but we presume that the director is going to exercise it in an appropriate manner. And, you know, to that end, the protocol that TDCJ uses is in the record. It's in the clerk's record at 60 through 71. And the prior protocols, and again, the protocol has basically been unchanged since 2012. So I think that the legislature has the knowledge of what TDCJ is doing. And Your Honor, returning to Article 4314, I think the most important part of that statute is the part that says such execution procedure to be determined and supervised by the director. And so to be determined in an ultra-vires case, I think that we're just looking at the source of the legal authority, and that is about as broad authority as the legislature could have granted to say that the director will determine how these procedures are set out. And so there's no textual indication in Article 4314 of an intent to incorporate other statutes. I think that the legislature certainly could have done that, but the legislature didn't do that. And so what that means is that the plaintiff's objections to what the director is doing, to what TDCJ officials are doing, so for example, how TDCJ officials are procuring the drug, whether there's a prescription or not, what quantity, whether it's being used past a by-use date. Those all go to discretion. But the question in this case is not about whether the TDCJ officials are exercising their discretion properly, but whether there's legal authority for them to do so. And so as long as they are acting within their legal authority, that is the beginning and end of an ultra vires claim. I'd also note a couple of things about the statutes that the plaintiffs cite and some clues and indication of why the legislature wouldn't have necessarily thought that those statutes would apply to Article 4314. So the Texas Pharmacy Act is about the delivery of pharmaceuticals and medications to the public and ensuring that those medications are safe and effective and that pharmacies are regulated. and that the Board of Pharmacy, which has oversight over that, can properly go in and inspect and make sure that pharmacies are acting in compliance with their obligations. But there's nothing like that in Article 43.1.4. In fact, the only thing that goes to that in Article 43.1.4 suggests the exact opposite, and that's the confidentiality provision. So in I believe it was 2015, the legislature amended the statute to say, look, whoever is providing these substances to TDCJ, their identities are confidential. And that is inconsistent with anything in the Pharmacy Act, which is about regulation and oversight. So again, there's this incongruity. The other thing I'd point out about the Pharmacy Act and the Controlled Substances Act and the Food, Drug, and Commerce Act is that all of those statutes are about medical prescriptions. And so if you sort of dig down into each of the definitions, definition of pharmacy, for example, definition of prescription, everything is about doing something for a medical purpose, regulating pharmacies that are diagnosing and treating illnesses or disease. And that's just not the focus of Article 43.1.4, which is about making sure that the state is conducting executions in a way that the legislature has deemed appropriate. I think you can also look at where those statutes are housed in their respective provisions of Texas law. So the Texas Pharmacy Act is part of the Texas Occupations Code, which is, again, about regulating an occupation. The Controlled Substances Act and the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act are in the Health and Safety Code, which is, again, regulating public health. And this is just something entirely different from that. And so I think when you're looking at ultra-virus claims, you're looking at the specific provision and what does that provision say and how broad is the authority in that provision. And Article 43.1.4 just has about as broad an authority as I think the legislature could have given.
Had the in the penal code that you're relying on, the statute says any substance, not any drug, it says any substance. Is it possible that the delegation of authority that the ledge gave you, defining it as a substance and not a drug, was directing the director to choose something else that didn't require a prescription, that didn't require all these other things? And I know that that's out there, but I've been perplexed at why everybody presumes that this is the only substance that the director could have chosen, phenobarbital, which, based on these other statutes, require a lot more steps to go through to get that substance.
So I don't think this is, and let me try to answer that in several ways, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this is the only substance that TDCJ officials had to use. I think that TDCJ officials had discretion to choose from, you know, any substance that could fulfill the purpose of the statute. But I think having chosen the substance that they did, that is the exercise of discretion, and it didn't require going through the Pharmacy Act and the Controlled Substances Act. And I think.
But why?
Well, I think because.
Because isn't he part of the public? He or she?
Well, I think because the statutes are inconsistent. I mean, there is no way that the state can fully comply with both statutes. And perhaps the most important part of that is that a prescription, a pharmacy has to, practitioner has to prescribe something for a medical purpose under the Pharmacy Act. The use of pentobarbital in executions is not for a medical purpose.
But when you just said that, you said that these statutes are inconsistent. Is it our job as the judiciary to make them consistent, or is that the legislature's job when now faced with the awareness of this lawsuit that's been pending through four legislative sessions, that they can look and see, well, there is some inconsistency as legal counsel has identified, and maybe we should clarify that inconsistency?
I would say the legislature wouldn't need to do that because the legislature has already done that in 43.1.4 in saying that this is the purview of TDCJ officials to determine the execution procedure. So I think it just comes down to reading Article 4314 and how to construe that. In our view, there will be no need to reconcile those statutes because the legislature has already dictated which statute applies in this specific context. And perhaps to your point about TDCJ being a part of the public and being regulated and all of that.
And the accused.
Yes, of course. TDCJ isn't saying that we are outside the Controlled Substances Act or the Pharmacy Act in other contexts. So, for example, of course, there are thousands of inmates. We provide health care contracted through University of Texas Medical Branch and Texas Tech Health Sciences Center. Of course, the pharmacists and the doctors and nurses and everyone else who is supplying medical care to inmates are subject to the applicable provisions of the Pharmacy Act and the Controlled Substances Act. So it's not a situation where we're saying we're outside those statutes altogether, but this is it's a very unique context. It's again, the most sensitive task I think government can be asked to do. And I think the legislature may have thought that there was a reason that not to cabin that discretion, because given changing situations, given the fluidity of what's happening outside of TDCJ in terms of obtaining the drugs to use, the legislature might have thought, look, we need to just let the TDCJ officials handle this in their best judgment rather than prescribing specific notions of what they have to do. Because again, the legislature could say something one year and that might be out of date the next year. And so it would make more sense. And hopefully the legislature's concerns and maybe the court's concerns are assuaged by the detailed protocols that TDCJ has published and that TDCJ rigorously abides by. And so there would never be a situation where the day of an execution arrives and all of a sudden it's an entirely different substance than the one in the protocols. I mean, the protocols are what TDCJ would follow. And ultimately what TDCJ is doing is acting within the broad authority granted in Article 4314. And for an ultra-vires claim, which isn't looking to, which again, the Eighth Amendment concerns can be litigated separately. If they're constitutional concerns, those can be litigated separately. But all we're looking at here is there legal authority? And because there is that legal authority in Article 4314, the case against the official should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. And let's hear from the appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Absolutely.
Appellees take no exception in this action with the director's exercise of discretion. Clearly, 43.14 contemplates a substance to be chosen. The issue here is the choice and its implications. The director, the current director, appellant Lumpkin, and prior directors have selected pentobarbital, specified in the execution procedure. And with that comes implications. It's a controlled substance. Controlled substance face the regulations that are addressed in our papers extensively and obviously are the bases for the five counts.
Counsel, may I ask you one question on that choice, the choice of the director and the consequences that may arise from that choice? As your opposing counsel indicated, this has been the choice since like 2012, 2013, and the ledge has met, and they even met in 2015 to infuse the statute with the confidentiality issue or the statute related to who the compounder is. What is your response to, they've had the opportunity, they've known the Pharmacy Act is there, they've known the Controlled Substance Act is there, they've known they've used pentobarbital, and they didn't change it, so they must feel the discretion is wide enough within the penal code as it exists now.
Your Honor, I think the implications of the regulatory regime with respect to the facts as to how pentobarbital is actually used is the animating feature of this litigation. And so what's come to light and what is before the legislature at this point in terms of the litigation and public information requests and the disclosure of documentation to a highly limited extent, but still illuminating, as to how the drugs are being handled and the grave problems and the violations facially in the regulatory regime around this controlled substance is what's precipitating the litigation. And so again, we take no exception with Appellant Lumpkin's choice of phenobarbital. The issue is it's a controlled substance. And with that comes expectations and requirements as to the handling of that. And the evidence that we have before the court with regard to the mishandling of this is egregious. And so these concerns are not only grave, they are matters of fact-finding in the district court based on uncontested evidence as to the implications when, as one must, the USP, which is the governing sort of pharmaceutical science body that is incorporated into Texas's administrative law, is applied to what is known about the given drugs that, in our case, were poised to be used for Mr. Canales.
In your view, could the administration of the lethal injection ever be considered medical treatment or medical procedure?
The medical purpose clause that's been highlighted, I'm glad you raised that, because the entire choice of phenobarbital is predicated on it being a medicine. It's a sedative. And so my learned colleagues' recitation of the sort of four concerns that the appellants believe limit the choice of substance apply with respect to the election of the given substance. The reason why a medicine was chosen and a sedative was chosen was to avoid Eighth Amendment problems and similar problems. So it's a medical purpose applied by medically trained individuals. The procedure itself, the execution procedure itself, specifies in painstaking detail the necessity of medically trained personnel conducting the execution. The appellants are responsible for verifying their credentials and qualifications. There's opacity there, we can't see that, but it's clearly central to the protocol itself.
So the medical purpose is to help avoid pain in the, I mean, is that your
That's the your principle point? Of okay. it, Your Honor, yes. So squarely a medical purpose, it's a medicine.
And counsel, how do you look at the argument of the appellants related to a ministerial task like having an execution at noon versus at 6:30, which is obviously clearly delineated in the statute, versus the discretion of choosing pentobarbital and choosing this confidential compounder as being the source? What, in the ultra-virus sense, how do you reconcile that?
So the substance choice is really the hinge here. And by choosing a controlled substance, the basic strictures that adhere to that controlled substance apply. And it's a bit of a red herring to say that it's disabling if the rest of Texas law applies as it ordinarily does to the public, which includes those who are condemned until they're dead. They still are members of the public, certainly. So there's no carve out to say if you're in prison or if you're under a death sentence, the TPA does not apply to you, the CSA does not apply to you. That's, of course, ludicrous on its face. So it applies to everybody in Texas, and a prescription is readily had, and the record is mixed as to whether prescriptions actually have been had. But whatever the case, the appellant's position is that there are no prescriptions here.
And to that point about the record, then what's your response to your opposing counsel's comment that you've cited these information about other states and their statutes, but that was not presented at the trial court and that's not part of the record? So what's your view on that?
It's a legal argument, just to show that this is not a disabling litigation. In other words, this is not a way to shut down the capacity of Texas to lawfully conduct executions under 43.14. And it's just showing other authority, such as Tennessee is a good example, where it's clearly contemplated when an execution date is set, a prescription is had for the given lethal injection drug, which has the same trappings as apply here with regard to confidentiality, secrecy, and what have you. So it's not a disabling sort of question that needs to be answered here. All we're insisting upon is TDCJ and the actors for TDCJ to use the controlled substance that Appellant Lumpkin has elected to use here in a lawful way.
But you agree under, or do you agree that, you know, under your position and your interpretation right now, it wouldn't be possible for anybody to receive the lethal injection in Texas, right?
With the drugs that they possess now, they possess now are tainted from what we understand.
With any controlled substance?
No, Your Honor. Any controlled substance would be usable. A prescription adhering to the TPA and the CSA would be necessary.
So could a practitioner lawfully write a prescription under your position?
Yes, and they do.
In this state?
In this state? I don't know. We don't know. The public does not know.
May private plaintiffs invoke the Texas Food and Drug Act? And if not, does that matter for ultra-virus purpose?
Theoretically, in other contexts apart from this one, I would assume so. I, as far as hypotheticals on that, I don't have that detour. It does not affect the jurisdictional question here. And with respect to that, we have five counts in the underlying petition. With respect to the jurisdictional question before the court presently, the state has to prevail on all five of those, and it prevails on none.
Okay. Any other questions, counsels? Colleagues, you may continue.
What I think is worth emphasizing, and I don't want to belabor it, is that we have findings of fact in our record here with respect to the implications of the state of the drugs in question. And these implications are grave. So there's no ambiguity with regard to what's before the court in terms of the gravity of the factual circumstances. The question of this legislative problem is not a real question, in that the framework that we've pointed to and relied on with regard to each of these counts reconciles utterly with Article 43.14. They simply need to be applied. And it is not a burden, an undue burden, remotely for the state, as evidenced by the practices of other states in their legal schemes with regard to lethal injection executions that also are protected by confidentiality and secrecy in much the same way as Texas. Okay. And unless there are further questions, I'll cede my time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. All right. Let's hear from the appellants. Yes, sir.
Make a few quick points on rebuttal.
Certainly.
So first thing I would talk about is just the evidence and what isn't and is before the court. So we're up, of course, on a plea, and so this wasn't an evidence-based plea, and so there's not going to be a lot of evidence in the record beyond what is in the petition, but of course that's not directly relevant here because this is a purely ultra-virus case about what is TDCJ, what can TDCJ officials do under their legal authority? And so the concerns that my colleague raised, I think, would be more appropriately raised in a constitutional challenge than in a case that's just about the director's legal authority. But I would note a couple of things just to highlight. First, probably the best part in the record where we address some of these factual issues is our response to the temporary injunction, which is at the clerk's record 434 to 51. And so that's where again, there wasn't evidence that it was just such a fast-moving situation. We didn't have, you know, we didn't put in evidence, but there's at least an explanation of sort of why factually we're doing things the way that they are. I'd also just note that perhaps the reason that the legislature hasn't been concerned over the past 10 years or so is that over 100 executions have been conducted with this one-dose protocol, and there have not been concerns in any of them with pain or other complications arising from those executions. And I think pointing to what other states do, I think only highlights the TDCJ officials' discretion here. The fact that this can be done differently in different states just shows that this is a process that might vary in the best judgment of elected officials. And here, the legislature has determined that our elected officials are best set in the best position to determine what protocol to use, and that's why it gives that broad authority to determine and supervise the relevant procedure. And finally, I think my co-counselor noted five counts, and one of them is a violation of the penal code, which I think is probably the most difficult for me to understand, because the notion that we're violating criminal law by possessing a drug and using a substance that the legislature has told us we have to have and we have to use is just counterintuitive.
Now, has the legislature told you you had to have that? They said you needed a substance. They didn't tell you which one. Y'all chose that.
That's right. And I think, and our position is that was within the director's discretion to choose that particular substance. And so I guess I would just close by reemphasizing the narrow question before the court, which is the legal authority of TDCJ officials under 4314. And with that narrow issue in mind, this has been the understanding in Texas law since 1978 that the director has very broad discretion in terms of how to go about performing this task. Thank you.
If I may ask one question, what is your response to the other side's comment about medical purpose, that the administration of this drug clearly has a medical purpose because it's being used to help ameliorate pain and suffering, and what's your response to that?
I would point to 551.02 of the Occupations Code, which talks about how the Act governs pharmacy and licensing pharmacies engaged in delivery of prescription drugs and devices used in diagnosing and treating injury, illness, and disease. And so that, to me, explains sort of the overall purpose of what a medical purpose would be. It's to treat disease, to treat illness, to treat injury. And this is not being used for a medical purpose. It's being used to carry out a sentence. And I just think those are fundamentally different purposes.
And what about under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, right? The prescription, this issue of a prescription also comes up. So what would be your argument for that?
I'd also point, I don't know that prescription is defined in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, so I think you can look to the Occupations Code again. I think all of these, the Controlled Substances Act and the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, they all hinge on requiring a prescription. I mean, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is a consumer protection statute designed, again, to protect the public health, to protect folks who are receiving medications that it is what the provider says that it is. Again, this is just a very different context. So I would just point to, I think the court can look back to the definition in the Occupations Code to address those concerns. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you both for bringing this complex issue before the court. The case will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you very much.
All please rise.